This is Gulf Coast Life. I'm Mike Canary. Thanks for joining us. It's always been possible to make false claims on the internet, and anonymity has always been possible to hide your identity or claim you're someone you're not. And when social media entered the story, it made it easy for anyone to become a content creator and proclaim anything they wanted to, whether it was true or not. In 2016, the nonpartisan global policy think tank RAND Corporation published a piece called The Russian Firehose of Falsehood Propaganda Model, Why It Might Work and Options to Counter It, that outlined ways Russia was flooding the internet and social media with false claims, and why this technique, which featured a lack of consistency or relationship to truth, was effective in both creating confusion and getting people to tune out because there was just too much information swirling around. The online world has continued to advance since 2016, and large language models have given people the ability to not only create images and videos that are not real, but create AI agents that can spread information on the internet that unsuspecting readers would have no way of knowing was false or being spread by a non-human AI agent. So I sat down last week with one of the researchers behind that 2016 piece to learn how it came about, how they did their research, and what it means through the lens of today, far beyond Russian propaganda. Let's hear that now. Dr. Miriam Matthews is a senior behavioral and social scientist at the RAND Corporation. Welcome to the show, Miriam.
Thank you for having me.
So for starters, just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and your areas of sort of research focus or academic interests.
I'm a social psychologist at RAND, and my work focuses on propaganda, disinformation, and the psychology of how people process information in high-volume media environments.
How long have you been at RAND?
About 13 years now.
Tell us a little bit about it. Explain for a listener, just in radio terms, what you guys do.
So RAND is a nonprofit independent research organization, and so we do research for various entities, including the Army and the Air Force. We look at the big, hard, hairy questions that the different organizations have.
So I was looking at your bio page, and you also have some interesting blends of topics like sexual assault and harassment. Is that just another area of your interest?
It is, yes. So harmful interpersonal behavior, sexual assault, harassment, hazing, bullying, suicide risk. I look into all of that as well.
Is there a natural overlap between those two or not?
There is. So it's part of messaging. It's part of changing attitudes. It's part of how people's behaviors are influenced by content that they receive, which can lead to negative behaviors or can help with prevention. So there is overlap there.
Interesting. So it could be interpersonal as much as it can be just, you know, global internet.
Exactly.
So how did this 2016 piece first come together? It's published in 2016 called The Russian Firehose of Falsehood Propaganda Model, Why It Might Work and Operations to Counter It. Is there like an origin story, if that even makes sense in the context of what you guys do?
Well, it grew out of my co-author, Chris Paul, and I. We were observing a recurring pattern in Russian propaganda. And so we noticed that it was extremely high message volume and rapid repetition and frequent contradictions. So we weren't really studying individual falsehoods. What we were trying to get at was the structure of how the information was being delivered. So it was less about a single data set and more about synthesizing this observed communication behavior that we saw and how that connected to psychology findings.
Who coined the term firehose of falsehood?
So that was Chris, because of the, you feel overwhelmed with the amount of information that's coming forth. So you're just blasted with multiple contradicting stories. And so that is the firehose nature.
So what was the research methodology behind it? How did you collect information? How familiar were you with the psychological side of it? Things like that.
Well, so we started with just collecting the various pieces of information that was in 2016 in terms of what we were seeing coming out of Russia, what was clearly connected to Russia, what were the messages, the different venues that Russia was distributing information, all of those sorts of things. So collecting everything that we could It was clearly connected to Russia. And then from the psychological standpoint, the question was, well, why is this effective? How are people getting persuaded by this if there is this complete lack of consistency? What's happening? And then that's where there are various psychological theories that can explain how this kind of tactic, which is not classical persuasion, how that works.
It's kind of counter to classical persuasion from what I understand.
Exactly. So in normal persuasion, you focus on one thing. It's the one belief that is often trying to be influenced. But in this instance, it's information overload. And so contradictions help. If every version of events conflicts, then people often stop trying to figure out what's true. So it's a little bit different from the shining a spotlight on one thing, and instead it's creating this mass, this fog of information that it's hard to see through.
I pulled a quote from the piece. Is it a paper or is it an article, by the way?
It is a perspective, is what we call it.
Perspective. Okay, I didn't know what to call it. I pulled a quote from the perspective that says the we characterize the contemporary model for propaganda as the fire hose of falsehood because of two of its distinctive features, the high number of channels and messages and a shameless willingness to disseminate partial truths or outright fictions. And so it's not based in reality. And I think you may have already touched on this, but it's not based in reality. And what I find really interesting is that the lack of commitment to consistency is like, it's part of what makes it so powerful, I think. As strange as that might seem to like a rational person.
Yes, exactly. And that was what we were, when you initially come across this method that's being used of disseminating falsehoods, of outright lies, of somewhat lies, and in the sense that somebody might have said something, but in a completely different context, it was peculiar. But when you rely on, or when you go back to psychological theory and research that's been done, it's, you can think of it as confusion itself becoming the objective in order to confuse people. So you're really interested in lots of conflicting events, lots of conflicting messages, and no one knows exactly which one is actually the big T truth because there's just too much out there coming from too many actors via too many different venues and avenues.
And this paper was published back in 2016, where if somebody like Russia were to do this sort of thing, they would have rooms full of human beings that were doing it under you know, false identities or whatever. We now live in a world where it's easier, or even, you know, it's possible anyway to do it without human beings. Have you guys continued along this line of thinking in terms of that aspect of it?
So we continued to look into this kind of tactic. We immediately after this project, or after the perspective, we were looking at, I believe it was the World Cup. And we looked at several million posts. That time it was Twitter, now it's X, and what we could see from that. And so what we found was that basically this massive global sports event became a vehicle for unrelated geopolitical messaging. So conversations about soccer in that context were being used to carry political narratives. And then we also looked at during the pandemic, so what messaging was coming out from Russia within the United States with regard to COVID and the pandemic. So it continues to be used in lots of different contexts. And we look to see, are the patterns the same? So do we still see repetition, rapid dissemination of information, lack of commitment to consistency, just many different falsehoods. And we do see that applied in lots of different contexts.
In terms of a human being and their psychology, other than getting somebody to be overwhelmed to where they might just kind of tune out, what are some of the hooks that these techniques, not just the overwhelming part, but some of the other parts, what are some of the human sort of nature things that make humans fall for this stuff?
Well, there are a few well-known effects. So the first is, and I think many people know this, that first impressions are very sticky. So if you're not worried about commitment to consistency or about promoting facts, then you can get information out first. And so that makes what people are exposed to first, whatever this inconsistent information is. And so that'll be sticky, that'll be persuasive. Then we also know that repetition increases perceived truth. So once you see something over and over again, people are more likely to believe that just by the nature of seeing it repeatedly. And then we also know that emotionally arousing content spreads much more easily than neutral information. So it's like emotion becomes rocket fuel for sharing information and topics.
And as we know, the algorithms like to drive things that cause engagement. And another word for engagement is emotional arousal.
That's correct. Exactly. So the emotional reactions are often faster than the more analytical ones.
I'd like to take a moment to reintroduce my guest. Miriam Matthews is a senior behavioral and social scientist at the RAND Corporation. It's a nonpartisan, nonprofit global policy think tank and research institution founded in 1948. She co-authored a perspective published by RAND back in 2016 titled The Russian Firehose of Falsehood Propaganda Model, Why It Might Work and Options to Counter It. We're looking back at it today through today's lens. If you'd like to engage with the show about this topic or any of our episodes, find us on our social media. We are WGCU Public Media on Instagram and Facebook. I got off social media about 4 years ago, and it became very frustrating. A, content started creeping in that I hadn't signed up for. But B, just too many people would share stuff that they, it seemed to me, hoped were true without trying to vet whether it was true. Is that an outcome of this kind of online propaganda model flooding everything?
Well, let's start. I think we can start with social media. So it's mostly human nature. So it's mostly human nature that's amplified by technology. And we know that these social platforms dramatically increase the speed and the volume and the visibility of messages. And those are the exact conditions that these psychological effects that we are referencing and the firehose of falsehood, that they take place. So you can think of speed favoring manipulation.
I have done several shows with a guy who lives here in Southwest Florida. He's a retired. He was an advertising executive for one of the biggest global advertising agencies in the world. And since retiring, his mission is to try to get the word out that, you know, in the early days of advertising, they didn't have rules about false advertising. And so it was a wild west. There was snake oil. They put in rules to rein that in. And his contention is because of, you know, the 1996, I think, Communications Act that still governs today, that we've left our social media especially, but our internet, just open to the world. And we've let people come in and use techniques like this. You know, is that something that you guys look at RAND in terms of, you know, some other countries might have more constraints. We want freedom, but we also have a wide open internet.
Right. It's something that we've definitely considered in various pieces. So in this context, as your friend has identified, the environment is louder and it's faster, but it's basically understanding the mechanism that gives us leverage. So an understanding what's being put out there, how it's being put out there, who's getting exposed to that, that can help us, help the government, help others, help those who are receiving the information, maybe better understand what's happening and then better be able to combat it. But there's not a silver bullet to this. There's not one easy fix to being able to address every single falsehood that's coming out. So you have to instead think about reducing the effects. So basically slowing reactions, having people consider that maybe what they're being exposed to is not true, reinforcing the more trusted sources that are working to put out fact-based information, and then trying to disrupt amplifications that can happen through social media. So you basically try to build resilience rather than chase the noise.
It just occurred to me, and this is just kind of off the cuff here, but you know how you can set up email systems to delay when you send? You can click send and have it delay it 2 minutes or whatever to give you a chance to think it over. They should put that in social media platforms where you click post and then it asks you in 2 minutes if you still want to post.
Yeah, people should test that. That's a really interesting idea where maybe that would address the emotional arousal component. If someone's given 2 minutes before they're allowed to post something, then maybe their emotions will have died down and they'll be less inclined to spread it. I like it.
We haven't brought up large language models, generative AI, AI agents operating under their own accord on the internet. That certainly wasn't a thing back in 2016. I did find some articles. You even guys, Rand, put out a paper last month or a perspective last month called Manipulating Minds: Security Implications of AI-Induced Psychosis. So I guess the ability to generate things that aren't real, that look real, just turbocharges this whole fire hose of falsehood technique.
Yes, exactly. So in our piece, we mentioned, and you brought up previously, the troll farms, where different individuals would go in and just spread as much misinformation and falsehoods as they possibly could. Now you don't actually have to have that because you can have AI create multiple different messages and put that out there and then determine what's stickiest or basically what's being seen the most, what's being shared the most, and continue with messaging down that. Down whatever that is, whatever it is that is resonating with people, just continue to throw messaging out. And AI can do that very quickly, very rapidly. So it's, again, the same kind of mechanism, but just supercharged, when you have this kind of automatic ability to create the messages.
This is going to be a strange aside, but have you ever read any Neal Stephenson?
I don't think so, no.
No, he's a science fiction sort of futurist kind of author, and he put out a book in 2019 where the sort of the original premise was that it was kind of set in now, and we'd gotten AI, and the internet was sort of filled with fake stuff. So a super rich person decided to create an army of AI bots, if you will, that would flood the internet so much that it would break it. So we'd have to come up with a way to do it where we knew who the humans were. And I feel like that's not really science fiction anymore. I feel like if they perfect this a little bit more, somebody could have a billion AI bots or something like that. It's pretty disturbing to me.
That's true. And it's not just messaging anymore. So, not just text-based messaging, the ability to fake videos, fake voices, multiple different ways of suggesting that a particular person or a particular group said or did something, is possible and is more easily created now than previously. So, it just becomes even harder. With each time that that happens, then there's usually subsequent reactions, so a response reaction or a action and a reaction, where all of these different ways to fake individuals, events, through images, through sounds happen, and then subsequent AI tool comes along to be able to test whether something is fake. Those aren't perfect yet, so it's just a constant process of going back and forth of an actor putting out falsehoods, misinformation, disinformation, and then trying to respond to that to identify what are fabricated images or voices and sounds.
Your perspective from 2016 focuses on Russia's use of this, but presumably we should all, as individuals, be looking at everything that we consume online through this lens. I think that would be something fair to say.
Yes, that would be something fair to say. But it's also, we have to acknowledge that that's really hard to do. And so I think going at it, trying to, with the perspective that this is happening, that it's happening all over the place, and that you can't just automatically believe something, that we might be more inclined, even if it's a fake message, to believe something that we believe, that if it resonates with us, we'll think that that is true, even if it's not. So we have to basically put on the raincoats, as we discussed in the piece. So acknowledge that we have these biases and these limitations, which nobody likes to do, but we do. We have confirmation bias. We like to know that, or we like to believe that whatever we think is true is actually true, or our opinions are felt by absolutely everyone. All of that exists. We each have that. It's a limitation. It's an efficiency sometimes. And so we need to go into processing this information with the knowledge of that we have limitations, it's coming at us, and so we need to be careful about what it is that we believe and that we share.
Do you look at the information world with a different eye just by, you know, nature at this point, like a musician who hears things that a non-musician might not hear in a song? I mean, do you just kind of, as you scroll through whatever it is you scroll through, do you see it maybe differently, do you think?
Yes, that much is for sure. It's, you wonder who the actor is that's putting out a message, if some video is actually true. Anytime you see RT on anything, I've seen people sharing that something sticky from Russia Today, RT, and that automatically raises flags for me. So the various actors that you can see, I can still consume the information, but with a more cautious eye.
And one thing we didn't even touch on is, and this is something that started popping up about 4 or 5 years ago, or at least that's when I think people became aware of it, was, you know, creating fake sites that look legit, like a legit news site, even though they're not, because that adds credibility too, right?
Exactly. So if somebody thinks that something is being produced by a legitimate news site, then that is sort of a marker, an indication of, well, there must be something true behind this. It looks credible. So, of course, you know, news site, they're going to have done fact checking. So I'm able to believe and share this information automatically. That's kind of playing off our bias there, our efficiency to try and quickly determine if something is accurate or not. And it turns out that there are lots of fake news sites out there that sometimes they might share true information, and then sometimes they might share false information. So it looks like a news site, and you don't know if the information is true or not. That's, again, contributing to this confusion.
You know, in terms of a positive effect of large language models and generative AI, are you able to use the tools that are available to collect data on what may or may not be real?
Yes. Yeah, so what we can do, what we have done is, so in different environments, you can go in and scrape every single blog, newspaper, all of that, and determine what the messages are and who the likely actors are for putting out those messages. And that can lead to some really interesting information. So using these tools, there are positive benefits because this massive information that's being put out there, one person would not be able to go through every single message. Instead, we can scrape large amounts of information from news sites, blog posts, Reddit, whatever, to be able to create a data set that allows us to see if there are patterns. So we're not chasing the individual fish, basically. We're looking for schools of fish.
Well, that's all the time we have. My guest is Dr. Miriam Matthews. She's a senior behavioral and social scientist at the RAND Corporation. Thank you so much for your time, Miriam. I've enjoyed our chat.
Thank you.
You can find a link to the 2016 perspective about the fire hose of falsehood method on our website, wgcu.org/GCL. You can find all of our past episodes there as well, and can subscribe to the show as a podcast wherever you find podcasts. Our show today was produced by yours truly. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM. We are NPR 4, Southwest Florida.